Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Hooked on Score. I'm your host, Rick Urban, and with me today, we have special guest composer from The Wolf of Snow Hollow, Ben Lovett. How are you, Ben?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing well, too. Thank you so much for being here today. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Ben. You probably recognize his music from his score for Netflix's The Ritual, which I actually watched this morning.
Quite a way to start one's day.
It really is. It's funny. I've heard about it since it came out in 2017. Is that right? A couple years ago?
We made it in 2017. It premiered at TIFF that year, and then Netflix put it out at the beginning of 2018, if I remember right. I don't know. I feel like ever since 2020, I'm living in time soup, and I just cannot understand any when things happened anymore.
Yeah, no, I think everyone is kind of dealing with that phenomenon. So he did the score for The Ritual on Netflix. He has worked with the Duplass brothers on their survival thriller Black Rock. He did a travel sci-fi noir called Synchronicity, which earned Ben a nomination for Discovery of the Year at the World Soundtrack Awards. Ben's recent picture is called The Wolf of Snow Hollow. This is from director Jim Cummings, and it is a, it's funny, everywhere I've looked for this movie, I have a different genre.
Yeah.
Nobody seems to know what it is. When I watched it, I just think it's a good movie. It doesn't need a genre. Some people call it, what do they call it? Tragic comedy.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if that's it, but it's more of a thriller, right?
Yeah, you know, it really is. One of the things that appealed to me about Jim's style in his films is it is very hard to kind of pin down exactly where it fits inside of a specific genre box. His first film, Thunder Road, people call it a comedy, people call it a drama. It's kind of both, but neither. You know, at any given moment, it sort of was a film that felt simultaneously poignant and heartbreaking and bittersweet, but it was also laugh out loud funny to me, even though nothing's ever played as a joke.
Yeah.
And there's no sort of set up humor. And it's almost like it's that awkward, uncomfortable thing where you're not even sure if it's okay to laugh at a certain thing because it's just so awful. You know what's happening? And so that was an appeal to me. And I felt like whatever that guy might be trying to do in anything that crossed over into something like horror would probably also be not quite horror, not quite comedy, not quite a thriller, not quite a drama, but somewhere in the middle of all that.
Yeah, absolutely. If you watch the trailer for it, you think it's a... I would describe it, if the Coen brothers did a horror film, you would probably end up with something like The Wolf of Snow Hollow.
Sure.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think for people who haven't seen it, I mean, the quickest comparison I can probably give to the style of comedy that exists would be like the Fargo style of humor, where really brutal imagery and horrible shit happens to people, but it's funny.
Yeah, absolutely.
At the same time, even though none of it's played as slapstick or humorous, it still comes across as entertaining and sort of self-aware and not trying too hard to kind of put you in that direction. So I think this has a similar sense. Like, and I think that one of the reasons that works is just to connect it to what you said about the trailer is that I realized during the scoring process that Jim would sort of pull me back anytime I was doing anything that was leaning into the comedy too much. He really finds that it works best when you're playing it straight. There's a difference between playing it for humor musically and playing it with just a bit of self-awareness is the best sort of word coming to mind at the moment, but just some sense of, because it's not quite tongue-in-cheek and it's not farce or satirical, you know. There's a responsibility you have to honor what's going on within the story at that moment, but it's also somehow you have to kind of tread this fine line to where you kind of go, but it's not, you know, it's not really trying to be a scary scene. It's just referential to scary scenes in horror movies as you're familiar with them, if that makes any sense.
No, absolutely. It came across what I think what you guys were trying to do with the movie and the score, I think came across to me, absolutely.
That's great to hear.
And it makes it a fun Halloween movie. If, like, you're looking for a movie to watch, because on Halloween, you don't want to watch something too scary. You want to watch something that's fun scary, right? And I think, like, this is kind of the perfect movie for Halloween, to tell you the truth.
I think that's the best adjective for them. I mean, that's the best adjective you can hope for just about anything, is it's fun.
Yeah.
Like, this, and I knew going into this, I was like, well, this will be a fun project to work on, and I think what we're trying to make is a fun movie to watch.
Well, we'll get into Wolf of Snow Hollow in just a little bit, but I kind of wanted to start off by talking a little bit about you and your background. Kind of ask you the same question we ask all of our interviewees, is how did you get started with music, and then how did that evolve into you becoming a film composer?
Well, I grew up in a fairly rural part of Georgia, and it was an area where small town in the middle of nowhere on the way to nowhere, and didn't grow up with any kind of music teacher or musical education I didn't play an instrument. It was just one of those things that it never really felt like it was something available to me. So it took a long time until I was a teenager and sort of discovered punk rock and kind of understood this concept of, like, you just do it anyway.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter that you don't know what you're doing. You meet, like, an intent with a passion and a work ethic, and you just figure it out. You just make stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And so I feel like my entire career has been one long sort of education on the job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been learning on the job ever since I first started. And so I started playing just, like, guitar, learning power chords and punk rock songs when I was probably 17, 18, almost out of high school. Went to college, and, like, 2 years later, met this group of kids who were in school who were making this movie. And it was students from the theater department and, you know, techie kind of guys from the journalism department who had access to cameras. And then, you know, these writer kids from the creative writing department. And it was this tribe of people who were getting together to make this movie. And someone suggested to them the horrible idea that they should get me to do the music, which I didn't know anything about, barely even playing music, much less writing, you know, 70 minutes of it for a feature film.
Yeah.
But, you know, they were sort of like, well, why are you scared of that? We don't know anything about making a movie, but we're going to do it anyway. And it kind of, like, doubled down on my whole, you know, thesis and ethos about why I was doing it to begin with. So I think that's how it started, you know, was sort of just being, like, checkmated into something where I had no good reason to say no to. And one leads to two, and two leads to four. And, you know, many, many years later, you are nominated for awards and doing werewolf movies.
So. Yeah, it's funny. I hear a lot of composers start with that, where they were making a movie with friends, and then friends suggested they did the music, and they're like, no, I don't want to do the music for a film. And then, you know, nowadays, when anybody has an idea for a movie, there's, like, 1,000 composers, like, circling their house being like, oh, do you need a movie? Do you need music? Here's my demo reel, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's funny.
Because if you want to do music for movies, you kind of got to know people making movies, you know, like you got to get into it's a lot easier to do when you're younger, because, you know, it's easier to, you're just kind of in the habit of meeting new people and making friends, and everything's new when you're 19, 20 years old. And so I felt really fortunate and lucky that I did just kind of stumble into at least just one initial group of people that were enthusiastic and inspired to make content and make films and just make anything. And, you know, because it's a business of relationships, all those people go off in different directions throughout their lives and careers. And then you just kind of never know where in the pinball machine of all of that, you know, you end up kind of, your name gets bounced around and people come looking for you.
Now, was that the film that you did with them in college? Was that The Last Goodbye?
Okay. No, the one we made in college, no one will ever see or should. But like, you know, it was like we, you know, it was a bunch of like 19-year-old kids trying to act like adults. But, but you know, we made it. It was just, you made it just to see if you could, you know, and we had like hosted screenings locally in our, this was in Athens at the University of Georgia. And this was in the mid to late 90s.
Okay.
This is like 97, 98, around that time. And it was a core group of people, including the writer and director of that movie, that wrote and directed Last Goodbye. So if you fast forward about 8 or 9 years later, that opportunity came along. He got funding for a script, and he had Faye Dunaway and David Carradine from Kill Bill and Kung Fu, before Kill Bill. And he had these people in his movie, and of course, I was the one who got the call to come score it. And you know, that sort of, that's why that's kind of the first thing that appears in the IMDb list, is because it's kind of the first movie that actually came out and anyone ever saw and did festivals. And that was sort of the starting point for all intents and purposes.
So then, I guess the next thing, just kind of rolling through your IMDb, comes The Signal in 2007, and that was kind of the film that sort of put you on the map of certain people, is that right?
Yeah, I think The Signal was a definite turning point. That was a $50,000 feature film made by what grew out of that initial thing I was talking about in Atlanta. I had already moved to California, but this group of artists and creative people in Atlanta came together and made The Signal for the shoestring of all shoestrings of a budget.
Yeah.
And it went to Sundance, and it was the first film to sell at Sundance that year, and it became this big story. And then it came out in theaters and kind of developed this cult following, and that sort of was a major turning point, because when that happened, it sort of confirmed what you want to believe is true, but you tend to get easily dissuaded from that, which is that, you know, you could get into something like Sundance by having no Hollywood people in your movie, no producers, nobody knowing anybody, no clout, no star power, no production value. You just had a good story, you know, a well-told story that was made by a lot of people with a lot of, you know, commitment, and you get into Sundance and sell your movie, you know? So it sort of made all of that seem attainable, and it made it palpable and real. And so it was kind of like, I should probably keep doing this. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, that from there, one thing leads to another, and I've just kind of been doing movies ever since.
Yeah, yeah, because from there, it looks like you've done a film, pretty much at least one project every year up until now. And then, you know, once you get into it more, multiple projects per year and things like that. It's funny, every time I look up one of your movies, regardless of how big or small it is. Like when I looked up The Signal, I started reading a little bit, and I'm like, I want to watch this movie. It's like, yeah. So I think I'm going to be going through some of your movies even after this interview is over.
But The Signal's interesting in how, I'm wondering it, because you look back and think about making that in 2005, 2006, and then it, you know, January of 2007 is when we premiered it.
Yeah.
So we had made it those previous years. When you look at where we're at now with the world and technology, and you kind of go back and think about what that movie is kind of centering around as a central premise.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how the movie holds up. I haven't seen it in forever, but as a story and as a premise for sort of like peril of modern times.
Yeah.
I think it's an interesting dilemma that we're kind of living out in a certain way.
Yeah. And it's told with three different story perspectives. Is that right?
Yeah. And that's probably an interesting thing for anybody listening, trying to kind of like get into doing more of this is, you know, a lot of times the things that open the doors for you and the, I mean, I don't know if this is encouraging or debilitating, but so much of it is out of your control because it's luck and timing and so many things have to work in your favor that you don't have, you know, kind of the control over. The Signal had three directors. So it launched not just the careers of one director, it launched three directors' careers. So for me, that was like exponentially valuable going forward.
Absolutely.
To multiply opportunities to continue working.
Yeah, and you were the composer for all three storylines, right? In the film. Yeah.
Yeah, I was sort of their idea was like each of the three of them would tell the story through the perspective of each of the three main characters with these three different directors in three acts, but they needed a score that could kind of thread all that together and make that not feel like three different movies.
Mm, yeah. And I'm just curious about this because I went through the same thing. Did the director ever bring up, or did the directors, I guess, ever bring up using a different composer for each storyline?
I don't know if they talked about that internally. It was never mentioned to me, and it was probably because they were like, we have like $500. Can you do that? It was like, we can't hire three composers. We can only afford one anyway.
Yeah.
So what can you do for that? And I was like, well, pretty much nothing. But, you know, So I was kind of on board from the beginning of that one, even at the script when they were writing it, and I had read several drafts of the script. And because it was a real moment of a community of people who were collaborating on projects, mm-hmm. You know, kind of in the indie, in that Atlanta scene, and it kind of grew out of that. Mm-hmm. I had the opportunity to kind of like be in the loop of it as it sort of all kind of came together.
Oh. And have you stayed in the Atlanta area or have you gone out to LA?
No, I grew up in Georgia, but I only lived there for the first like 20 years of my life. And then after about 22 years, I guess. I was about 22 or so. And then I moved and bounced around and I lived in Los Angeles for a long time and have spent a lot of time in the cities. And now I kind of hide out in a little town in North Carolina called Asheville.
Oh, nice. I've heard that's where people are starting to move to. It's just like an easier way of living out there, apparently.
Yeah, you know, it's not bad. It's not bad. I didn't really plan to move here. I just started spending so much time here that I realized that I live here.
It's like might as well move the studio, right?
Yep.
Did you do any sort of a film school or besides University of Georgia, did you do any like internships or anything out in LA?
University of Georgia, I was actually in the philosophy department. So I wasn't studying film or music or anything like that. It was just something that I was doing as a creative interest outside of school and everything else. And then throughout most of my career and even still, I was always, you know, producing other artists' records and like doing songs of my own and co-writing songs with other artists. And so for a long time, it was just, I never really thought of myself as a film person or a composer. It was just something I would end up doing once a year or a couple times a year as projects sort of came along, but I was never really chasing it or pursuing it as a career. I was just making stuff, putting stuff out there and meeting people, and then opportunities would sort of at the beginning, they would just sort of come organically.
Wow. Well, you've definitely taken advantage of your opportunities because everything I've listened of yours, I've liked. So it's been...
Oh, that's great. It's been I can't even say the same thing about myself.
Well, maybe, I don't know, send me some of the stuff that's really bad and then I can kind of have a better level playing field, I guess. I want to jump into Wolf of Snow Hollow because I just watched this movie the other night. I should say that this is directed by Jim Cummings, which you mentioned before. Is this has Robert Forster in it? Is this his last movie?
His last performance.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's...
He passed away right around the time we were finishing the... I think we had just finished the final mix and they were doing the color. And I think he did get to see the final version of the film, but it was just right after we finished the movie.
Wow. It's... Yeah. It's... He's one of those actors, if you don't know Robert Forster, once you see his face, you know... You know...
Yeah.
Oh, that's Robert Forster.
Guy. Yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
He was nominated
actor.
For an Academy Award for Jackie Brown. He was in, he's been in David Lynch stuff. He was in noir films way, way back in the day.
Yeah.
He's a legend.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And this movie is sitting at 89% on Rotten Tomatoes, so people are really enjoying it. I loved it, tell you the truth. You can find it on, so this was, I'm imagining this was probably something that was going to go through the festival circuit before all the pandemic happened and then get released
in
theaters.
Interestingly enough, Orion Pictures was on board this from the very beginning. They greenlit the script. And I think they were probably really interested in Jim, as a lot of studios were, after what they saw him do with, you know, again, just a shoestring budget, a crew of dedicated people, and a great idea and a great script, what they did with Thunder Road. And so I think he probably had people... you know, approaching him and was taking meetings, and he had this werewolf script, and Orion said, you know, let's do it. And so they were on board, but that we finished the movie right before pandemic, and then it's just kind of sat in COVID jail for the past 10 months or whatever.
Right now, it's on a number of different places. I bought it through Amazon, but you can find
and
it on...
it's in theaters right now, too. It's in like 100 and something drive-ins and theaters, wherever theaters are open. I know a lot of the Alamo Draft Houses have it.
Oh, nice.
And a lot of the theater chains that are doing some socially distanced type screenings. And, you know, I don't even know. I know, like, I think they're all still closed in L.A. and New York and places. But I know a lot of cities that where they're open are showing the movie right now.
Fantastic. Yeah.
But so, like you said, it's on VOD and you can watch it at home, too.
Yeah, it's kind of the best of both worlds. If you want to see it in a theater, you can. If you want to watch it right now, it's you can get it on YouTube. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it on... a number
iTunes.
Of different places. iTunes, yeah.
Apple TV, yeah.
Yeah, like I say, I watched it. I really enjoyed it. The music is mixed kind of like a dream. It's right out front of everything. You can really sink into the score, which probably made you happy upon listening to the final product, I imagine. and there's just a lot of good music. It takes a pretty... I don't want to talk too much about it because there are spoilers involved that are very fun when at the end of this. But as far as you approached it, when you first started talking with the director, did you guys settle on a genre that you were going for?
He really more talked in... more descriptions and adjective-driven kinds of, you know, talking about, you know, describing some of the emotion in the scenes initially. And me just kind of watching the cut of what they had, you know, a lot of times when you come on board a project that is already in the editorial stage, they've had some temp score and things put on there. And a lot of times that process is difficult to nail down what the tone of the film is because... temp scores make the film feel very scattershot and sort of all over the place tonally because it's music from 10, 15 different movies sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then you have Jim's style, which sort of obscures an immediate sense of understanding the tone. It's kind of messing with your ability to determine the tone sometimes. Mm-hmm. For some people, frustratingly so, and for some people, they really enjoy it. Yeah. And so it was challenging to figure out in the initial, like, starting point, like, what is the sound of this movie and how's it supposed to feel? And so really it was a bit of an exploration of, you know, how do you do those things we were talking about at the outset? How do you find one kind of toolbox of sounds and or style that can kind of touch all those bases and can kind of play to the comedy but not too much, speak to the action and horror, but not too much. You know, there's actually some legitimate dramatic, like, nice human moments
absolutely.
In this.
Yeah.
How can you be not be farcical about that or have it come across? How does the dramatic stuff not fall flat if you've earlier been setting up things that are funny? And so anyway, in trying to navigate all that, and something just about the way Jim's movies feel, I kind of landed on this, like, what if we do this, like, low-budget Hitchcock thing? Like, what if we do this, like, Bernard Herrmann, indie-sized Bernard Herrmann thing?
Yeah.
Like, we could never afford to do something like that, but mm-hmm. could you just take it as a broad stroke point of inspiration mm-hmm. for something that feels very big and ambitious, but the size of it is actually quite small and kind of chamber-sized? And because with all of these things, you can't just run wild with your concepts because you're hemmed in by logistical restraints of budget and time. And so you have to kind of work within the means of what you can actually pull off. And I kind of tend to have a habit of, like, not measuring those ambitions very well and, you know, going broke working on these things because I just want to put it all on screen. But I don't know, every now and then, and this might also be something useful to people, is like, every now and then you get a sense where that investment will pay off in the long run. So you go, I might walk away from this actually with no money in my pocket, but if I can just cover my bills and expenses while I'm working on this so I don't lose money being a part of this project and put everything else into the score, then maybe that pays off on the job that I get from what I was able to do. Yeah. And I do think that, like, you can't always do that and you can't never afford to do that. You know, if you just play it safe and you're always, then it's just a job and you're like, you gotta kind of, it's a high risk business, so you gotta take some of those risks. And this one for me just felt like, well, what if we really try to swing for something that's probably beyond the means of what this movie can afford? But let me see if I can figure out a way to sort of put that together and make it work.
So the there are a lot of organic sounding instruments in here. I don't know if they're samples or live players, but if they're samples, it sounds real. So you did a great job either way.
it's all live. It's about we had about 8 strings, 5 horns, a couple of woodwinds. I did all the percussion myself. Yeah. You know, it was that thing of like, how do we take a small number of players that I can afford and create a sound that is a little bit bigger than that. And so I recorded here in Asheville, you know, I recorded with players from the local symphony orchestra here who are really excited to come in and play on a film. And, you know, those guys play Rachmaninoff concertos and so they can handle anything I would write and throw at them, but they were really, you know, excited to work on the film. And, the studio used one here instead of doing it in LA, and just finding a way or a means to kind of like, deliver something, kind of over deliver on where the expectation line might be, sometimes pays off. And that was like a fun challenge to take on with this.
The movie works you through all the different angles, like you said, where it does have moments of horror, moments of drama, and like sort of there's a personal sort of family drama aspect of it. And then there's comedy built in, and in a way it gives you this opportunity to sort of showcase all of your different, you know, styles of writing. And I think you did a really fantastic job with it.
Oh, thanks, man.
The one part that I noticed is anytime, well, we should set it up a little bit for the soon-to-be viewers of the movie. It's there is a town in Utah called Snow Hollow. And as I was watching, especially the beginning of it, I said, so this is a film that you're watching and you feel like you're at Sundance. So
yeah, right.
So this would be a perfect movie for Sundance because you're kind of looking outside and you're like, oh, that's there. Okay, cool.
It's like everybody's dressed like they're at Sundance.
Yeah, exactly. But there is something killing people in this town, and the movie tracks throughout there. There's spoilers that I don't want to give away because they're so much fun. I can say that what you want to see, you end up seeing, which is very enjoyable for me. Just like in the other big film you did, The Ritual, you get to see the monster eventually, and that's a big, fun moment in both films. But I did notice that every time a victim happened, the music changed drastically. The biggest one, the first one, the second you see the dead body, it becomes a horror film. And then after the second one, it sort of takes on that Coen Brothers feel to me. That was one of my my favorite tracks. The soundtrack, by the way, is available on Spotify and on your website. What's the track? When he sees a second victim, I think it's called
Second Crime Scene.
Second Crime Scene. Yes, that's my favorite track on the soundtrack. It just takes on the score takes over the film almost. It becomes such a big important part of it. Was that an important moment in the film for you as a composer?
And that second crime scene was one of the hardest ones to nail down exactly because it's a long one shot that tracks him throughout this as he moves all around the crime scene just trying to manage the circus of activity going on around him. And there's something in kind of Jim's posture with the character, and like he's just so tense and he's so angry and he's so riled up. And it's just like, it's just so absurd, you know? And it's absurd in the way of like anybody can identify just trying to like manage all the spinning plates around them when they feel like it seems like you're the one acting crazy, but to you, you're the only one who's not out of their mind right now.
Yeah.
You know, trying to speak clear and just trying to kind of like, it just takes a shift into that. It's almost like a Fellini movie or something there. It just kind of, it's like there's this circusy kind ofness to it that is really kind of getting into his perspective of these events and the manic energy of that. A clip that Jim sent me of, it was a piece from the original Romeo and Juliet score. And it's like a, it's like a 75 piece orchestra. It was like a live, he just sent me this YouTube clip and he was like, we need something like this, you know? And it was like this like huge Russian symphonic, you know, and it was like 75, 80 people. And I was like, and I should add, this was Jim's first opportunity to work with a composer on a feature on his first film. There's like three music cues in the whole movie and he did them himself. And they're just, you know, they're very like, it's like one instrument. And so he had a lot of enthusiasm and excitement for all the different things he wanted to do. So part of the job sometimes is sort of at least managing the expectations of the other people to kind of go like, well, we couldn't even afford to do one cue with that that's like this, much less a whole score.
If you increase your expectations, you can increase the budget and then it'll all work itself out. But a lot of times...
Well, I'm always like, great, this sounds awesome. Who's paying for this? I can't wait to do that.
Yeah, that's a dream come true.
But I got the sense of how sort of big, like his ambition, his excitement, and kind of how it was at least instructive in just like how sort of bombastic and kind of audacious he wanted it to be. And so, you know, again, within that more restrained palette of that lineup I mentioned of just like a few horns, a few strings, some percussion, and, you know, it was just like, what can we do that still has the feel of that? You know, that because the film... Just to connect it to what you said about Snow Hollow as a location, you're in this one little small ski town the whole movie. So there's a sense of containment and sort of a small, you feel like you're in this little tiny ski resort town. And so everything has the, like you kind of got to do it to the scale of what the movie looks like sometimes, you know? And so, or feels like. And so this idea.
Like a local feel.
Yeah, very. And they're like, they're the local sheriff's deputies trying to solve these like serial killer murders, you know, these this series of events that keep happening. And so the idea was like, can you pack like a really big problem into a really small package?
Yeah.
And how might that sort of speak to the aesthetics of the film?
A song collaboration in this too, is that right?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It's the song that's in the trailer.
The Red Riding Hood.
So that is Little Red Riding Hood is a song from the 60s. It's Sam the Sham did the original version, and there's been covers through over the years and things like that. But it's a much more kind of like campy sort of upbeat. You know, he's like, oh, hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. And so, like, that's kind of the version that people tend to do and is most familiar with. And, you know, we kind of had this idea of, like, well, what if we cover that song? I mean, it's a werewolf movie. If we just cover Little Red Riding Hood.
Yeah.
And Jim had the idea of, like, what if it's a girl singing it? Because typically you hear a guy singing. It's all about the from the perspective of the wolf. Mm-hmm. And when you stripped away the delivery of the original version of the song, and you just look at the words, and you just focused on the lyrical content, you realize that, like, well, this is a story that can be told several different ways. And the idea of having sort of a slow and kind of spooky, sexy-sounding kind of thing, and a woman's voice singing it just took on a different context and meaning, and it just was an idea that felt worth exploring.
Yeah.
And Valentina, who's the vocalist on it, who performs under Valen, I had written a song with her, talked to her like years ago, called her up, talked to her about this idea, and she just did an initial scratch like on her piano demo and sent it to me, and I was like, this is totally gonna work. And so I just sort of took her vocal pass and did a whole arrangement and built up everything around her original vocals, and then just, you know, she came back and cut her final at the end, and that's how we did it.
Riding hood, you sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad wolf could want.
A website where when you buy the EP of the soundtrack, you get those tracks to mix on your own. Is that still something that is out there or no?
It is. Yeah. So if you go to iTunes or Spotify or Bandcamp or anywhere you can buy and download the tracks, we put the song out as a single, but it's on an EP with four other versions. And one version is just the instrumental. And then one version is just her vocals by themselves.
Okay.
And then another one is just the orchestra and her without the drums and guitars and the bass and everything like that. And so it just kind of like gives you some different ways of kind of listening. It takes on a different experience each time.
Wow.
But it's also like, I don't know, we just kind of had this idea like, I mean, it's a classic tune. We did this different version of it and it was fun to do. Why not sort of put that out there and see if people want to create their own version of it.
that's a very cool idea. The film overall, again, Wolf of Snow Howl. It is available in theaters. It is also available on Amazon. If you're like me, you can buy it. And to tell you the truth, I bought it and I will watch it more than once because it's one of those too where after you watch it, you want to go back through it and rewatch it to catch all the things that you might have missed, all the hints and things like that. So it's a fun rewatch as well. Perfect for Halloween. The other big one that you did was The Ritual, and there are two completely different scores. The Ritual is pretty hardcore horror in the music of it. Could you tell us a little bit about The Ritual score as far as your approach to that? How did you approach that maybe differently than Snow Hollow?
Well, on The Ritual, that entire score was done in London. I had to write and record and produce the whole score.
Oh, wow.
In London. The film was an entirely UK-based production. They shot in Romania, but the whole production was out of the UK. And so I was one of, the director was American, and I think I was the other American on the thing. And so one of the conditions was I had to go there to do it. And so I basically relocated to London and spent about 3 months over there trying to conceptualize and find players and like figure out how I was going to make the score, you know, in London where I didn't really know anybody.
Wow.
And that really kind of shaped the experience in a very distinct way because there was nothing to do but work on this movie while I was there. Like I didn't do anything but work on this movie.
Hmm.
And the other part of it that I think gives it the quality that it has is that I recorded that score with the London Contemporary Orchestra.
Okay.
And they are known for doing all of Johnny Greenwood's scores and Tom York's.
Oh.
And they do these really incredible live performance screenings of things like There Will Be Blood and Moonlight. And
wow.
They're just a tremendous outfit. And are very sort of selective and particular about what they work on because they kind of have a brand and they have a style and they like very modern, cutting edge mm-hmm. type music. And I was, you know, extremely fortunate to get to work with them and flattered that they liked what I was writing and liked the movie. And they came on board and just took everything that I was, you know, struggling mightily to try and kind of get to sound and feel a certain way and just, you know, knocked it out of the park.
It's kind of nice when you can do that with an orchestra where you can do that with guitarists and drummers and, you know, you can say, here's the idea. Can you just sort of play with that? But you can't really do that with an orchestra.
Yeah, they're like, well, you kind of need to put it on the paper in front of me if you want me to play it. Yeah.
Yeah, especially with contemporary pieces, there is a little bit of that where, you know, they get the part and they look at it and they're like, oh, did you mean this here? Yeah, okay, cool. We know what you're going for. We got it now.
It's also that like it was a very technique driven score. So it's a lot of like it's less about the well, I'm gonna say less. It's as much about the musicality of it
mm-hmm.
than the or at least about the tonality than the musicality.
Okay.
If that makes any sense. Like how it sounds was as important as what they were playing, right? Is kind of basically what I'm saying. And so for a film like that where it's a very textural score for a lot of it, just trying to induce a certain feeling and mood and emotion into the scene, it would you know, they sort of invent these techniques and they kind of come up with these own their own ways of kind of creating certain kinds of sounds that are sort of unique to that specific orchestra. And so that's kind of what I mean is knowing like, okay, we're doing sort of like a, you know, a heavy, thunky, you know, Bartok pizzicato thing. And then they kind of say, well, we have this one thing we do where, and they pull out their wallets and, you know, they like, they have a technique where they play the pizzicato parts with their Oyster cards, which is like their Metro card.
Like a pick. Like a big pick.
It's like a big pick. And so they just kind of interpret the sound and offer you like, well, check this out, because you're describing like what you're trying to get from the part, and then, you know, then they kind of give you this thing that's just like a different variation of something that you've heard, and you're like, yeah, like that.
That's it.
That's it. That's what we're trying to get to. And so that's kind of what I mean, is like when you have, you know, players who can kind of put a little bit of themselves into it and kind of meet your idea with a little bit of their own creativity, you know, it's just the best.
So you have another film coming with that same director. Is that, mm-hmm. is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
And when is that? Is it in post already? Is it done? Is it
well, we sold it at Sundance. It premiered at Sundance this year, and Searchlight bought the film and planned for a big worldwide theatrical release, and then the world fell apart into a global pandemic.
Oh.
So we don't know when it's coming out. We're just sort of waiting to hear when that film. It's called The Night House. It's starring Rebecca Hall and Sarah Goldberg, and I'm as proud of that film as anything I've ever done. I mean, it's kind of, I've done stuff this year since then, but that's one of the most recent films that I did that sort of has been seen and reviewed and, you know, has been.
So you've got, well, in a way, it's kind of nice that you have projects that are lined up, ready to be released whenever the world starts again. And now that it is starting to start again, stuff is popping out right away. And and I'm sure if you're like other composers, when everybody like shut down, we kind of kept going because it's like, oh, well, I'm still going to go to my studio and compose by myself for 16 hours today. I know everything else shut down, but I got work to do kind of thing.
It's made for a really unique version of what is a very unique and strange experience to begin with for me. And I know probably I'm not exclusive in this category, but it's like I was committed to a bunch of projects that shot last year that I had agreed to back in November, December, January. And so I've been working on all those things all year, but nothing new has come up because nothing's been shot and everything's been stalled. So I it's a very solitary occupation for most of it. You know, you spend a lot of time in a room alone. So
absolutely.
I've just continued working my ass off straight through all this, but I don't know what the next 9 months are going to look like in the next 12 months. And I don't know, you know, I think a lot of people had the rug pulled out from under them when all this hit.
Mm-hmm.
And they definitely did. And I feel myself and I know probably other people in our situation are just at least fortunate that we've had a moment to kind of brace for the impact of what's probably going to hit us kind of on a delay.
Yeah.
So I'm getting ready for that.
Well, I know that studios in Atlanta are back up and running, I think, at this point. They're starting to shoot stuff more and more. And who knows, maybe because of this, you know, the video at home on-demand services are getting better and better every day, obviously. So,
And rent that, you know, buy and rent those movies because, you know, we need to still have movies that exist when this is all over. And people might not understand how dangerously perilous, you know, the situation could end up being for the industry because all this stuff is such a house of cards that's not really built to withstand long periods of, you know, just like the airlines and all these other things where it's not really built or designed to survive a elongated period of just draining, losing, bleeding money. And so, you know, if you want movies to still exist, support them now.
Yeah.
From home if you can.
I know everybody. Well, I've been doing it with restaurants that I want to see stay open.
And of course, that's true about everything, right? Yeah. Whether it's movies or the bakery down the street, you know.
But I feel like going up to my local AMC and just being like, here's $30. Just take it.
Yeah, just put it with the rest.
Like, yeah, here, just come on. Just keep movies coming out. I want to see Tenet.
Yeah.
Well, Ben, where can people go besides Amazon to watch The Wolf of Snow Hollow?
Yeah, I think it's everywhere. I think if you type in.
Yeah, but where can they go to find you? I know you have a website.
Oh, me? Oh. I've benlovett.com is terribly outdated, but full of content. I just have not slowed down and had time to put anything up there recently, but there's all kinds of stuff up there. I have a website that if you click on the movie posters, each of those opens you up to a page for that film that has, a lot of them have some really nice behind the scenes featurettes, and there's several of those on YouTube on the Lakeshore Records, website who have done the soundtrack releases for several of my films. We've put together these really cool little, you know, 5 minute fun little, like if you like The Ritual, go look up the little 5 or 6 minute making of video of us in the studio. And it's kind of really gives you a sense of what a roller coaster experience that was.
Huh.
And yeah, I mean, all the there's tons of releases on Apple Music and Spotify and everywhere you stream music, you know, as a bunch of albums of film scores and songs. And
oh, fantastic. Well, I want to thank you so much for spending time with us today. It's been just a joy to talk to you. And I'm, like I said, I genuinely really enjoy your music and the movies. It seems like you are, you either are very good at choosing projects or projects that are very good choose you often. Well, that's it for this week on Hooked on Score. Thank you so much, and we will see you next week.
Cheers.